Today on Maine Calling, Maine's role in the American Revolution. Bunker Hill, Saratoga, Yorktown. The most famous battles of the Revolutionary War did not happen in Maine. But Maine and its people were not on the sidelines. Not only did men from the province of Maine serve in the Continental Army, but also the 1775 invasion of Quebec came after a brutal march through western Maine. And of course, the essential battle over what the Revolution stood for played out in a very real way between landowners and common people in Maine. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, we will learn about Maine during the American Revolution. Two-time Pulitzer Prize-winning historian Alan Taylor, who is a Maine native, joins us, as well as the director of the Maine Historical Society. Their exhibition, Pathways to Freedom, is part of the celebration of America's semi-quincentennial. Maine Calling is just ahead.
Maine Calling is made possible by support from Rennie's, a Maine shopping adventure with 19 locations across the state, now open in Bangor and Waterville. And Quarry Cottages at Highland Green, committed to providing low-maintenance living and dedicated to creating a community where residents are free to pursue their passions. And Bangor Savings Bank, committed to helping Northern New England communities thrive. You matter more. Bangor.com. And North Yarmouth Academy, a 2025 AP Platinum School recognized by College Board, inviting families to tour campus, shadow a student, and explore its new dormitory.
I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. What role did Maine play in the American Revolution 250 years ago? To answer that question, we are joined by Alan Taylor, who is a former Thomas Jefferson Chair of History at the University of Virginia, two-time Pulitzer Prize-winning author, and also a Maine native and Colby College graduate. Also with us for the hour today is Steve Bromage, who is Executive Director of the Maine Historical Society. We invite you to join the conversation. What were you taught about the role of Maine in the American Revolution? What questions do you have about the war and life back then? You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, post a comment on Facebook or Instagram, or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. Alan Taylor, Steve Bromage, to both of you, welcome back to Maine Calling. Really looking forward to this conversation today. Steve, I'll have you start. Set this up for us. Give us some basic facts. We know that 250 years ago, Maine was still a province of Massachusetts. How many people lived here? How many were loyalists? How many were patriots? And how many served in the Continental Army?
All great questions, and thanks for having us. Maine was still, from a European perspective, very much a frontier at that point in time. I think it's estimated 45, 50,000 people or so, perhaps, spread along the coast. It was complex and messy. And actually, Alan, one of my favorite kind of descriptions of that time period in Maine is in Liberty Men and Great Proprietors, which communicates how difficult it was to live in Maine at that time. The conditions, the soil, the food. I mean, it was a really rough time. But Mainers and Maine was very central to the revolutionary story. Geographically, Maine was centrally located and of great strategic importance. And like life today, you know, people had all sorts of different perspectives about the British, about what it meant to be living here in Maine. And there were a lot of complex relationships.
Yes. And you mentioned Liberty Men and Great Proprietors, of course, one of Alan Taylor's books, and it is about what was going on in Maine in that period of time. But I want to get back to you, Steve, just very quickly. Do we know how many people from Maine served in the Continental Army?
Alan may have better numbers, but I think it's estimated in the thousands. And there was very active participation. Folks came from here and they went and they fought in different theaters of the war. They were involved formally as part of the Continental Army, but they were also involved as privateers and more subtly and here, there, and the other place. I think everybody was involved and engaged at some level. But in terms of the actual number in the Continental Army, is that a couple thousand, Alan, do you think?
Well, it's almost impossible to know. What I think, and your point is that there are a variety of ways in which people serve. And the most common way is to serve in the militia. So a lot of people served for short stints in the militia. And probably in the course of the war, the vast majority of Maine men would serve in the militia. A somewhat smaller number would go off to the Continental Army. But after the war, thousands of people, many of whom have been veterans of the Continental Army, like Joseph Plum Martin, who settled up in the town of Prospect, there's a big surge of veterans of the Continental Army that comes in after the war.
Oh, interesting. And for our audience members that may not know the difference, can you explain, Alan, what would be the difference between serving in the militia and serving in the Continental Army?
Sure. So everybody who is over the age of 16, with a very few exceptions, such as being a minister of a church, is expected to serve in the militia, and you're expected to come up with your own firearm. The training for this is almost non-existent. They would have one training day a year, and they spend probably more time drinking during that day than they do actually drilling. But the militia is there in case of emergencies. So they are not to be called up for long stints or to go across boundaries into another jurisdiction. And so that's the default mode by which people serve in the military, is in this militia, which involves almost every able-bodied man or adolescent. The Continental Army is a regular army. Now, this means that people are there day in and day out, and they are being very strictly trained, and they cannot go home. If they go home without permission, they're deserters, and they could be punished up to death for being a deserter. So the Continental Army is a much smaller military enterprise, but it's absolutely essential to have this core of disciplined troops who can go toe to toe with the British.
Alan, Steve mentioned that maybe 45,000-50,000 people lived in the province of Maine, and he hinted at this, but your book, Liberty Men and the Great Proprietors, goes into this in great detail, that even among those whose hearts were with the patriots, even among those people who considered themselves patriots, there is a huge variety of opinions about what that meant, and it was really very different whether you were a landowner or a common person, correct?
Well, particularly after the war is over, because thousands of these relatively poor people who are from Massachusetts or Connecticut or New Hampshire are looking for land. When the Continental Army is demobilized, they don't receive any pay. They're not receiving any pensions. They're not even at that time receiving any land grants. So these people would move up to the region, particularly between the Androscoggin River and the Penobscot River in the interior, and they would claim farms for themselves as homesteads. But there was no Homestead Act. And they are clashing then with people who called themselves the great proprietors, who are large-scale land speculators, like the Kennebec proprietors or the Waldo proprietors. And it turns out the Waldo proprietors are led after the war by a former Continental Army general, Henry Knox. So we end up having this conflict after the war over what is the meaning of the revolution? Is it to provide opportunity for large numbers of common men and their families, or is it primarily to benefit the top tier of society that included people like General Henry Knox?
And the irony is that those people were granted their land by the king, the very king that they had just broken away from, correct?
Well, they've been granted these lands technically by the crown, but through the government of Massachusetts and very large tracts of land. And this goes back to the 17th century or the very early 18th century. So the irony is that it's actually these pre-existing, pre-revolutionary land grants that the political order in Massachusetts and the courts of Massachusetts decide will be perpetuated despite the revolution.
Steve, you wanted to jump in? Go ahead.
Yeah, one of the absolute gems in the Maine Historical Society collection is all of those proprietors' records. So we have the full documentation through treaties, maps that outlines the land distribution of Maine by those proprietors in that time period that Alan mentioned. All of those records are fully digitized and accessible online on the Maine Memory Network. We had a big federal grant a couple of years ago to digitize them all. So if people are interested in their corner of Maine and what was going on and who had the land when, I mean, incredible maps, little lot by lot. It's a fascinating resource for people to go in and get a feel of what the land looked like and how it was distributed prior to and then during and after the Revolution.
Many of us in school, we learn about the Battle of Bunker Hill. We learn about Saratoga. We learn about these big battles. We learn about Valley Forge in history. We don't learn about battles that happened in Maine, but that does not mean nothing happened here. How's that for a double negative? Alan Taylor, tell us about the March on Quebec and why you think it might be kind of lost to history and why it was significant.
Well, that march happens during the summer and fall of 1775. And just to set the stage, the war erupted in the spring, in April, Lexington and Concord. And then the Continental Congress, based in Philadelphia, decided that the cause of ousting the British from Boston would be a Continental cause. So they create a Continental Army, and George Washington is in command. And there are units there, not just from the New England states, but also from Pennsylvania and Virginia and New York. And Washington is impressed by an ambitious, very ambitious young officer named Benedict Arnold. And Arnold is urging an invasion of Canada. Well, why invade Canada? Because the British had forces there, and they potentially could organize Native Americans along the frontier and create problems for these rebelling colonists. And so Arnold's idea is there'll be a two-pronged invasion. One prong will go north from New York in along Lake Champlain to hit Montreal. And then Arnold suggests that he could lead a backdoor expedition that would go up the Kennebec River and then the Dead River, cross over to the Chaudière River, and then come down right by Quebec and slip in behind the British, who would be busy defending Montreal. So that's the concept, and Washington's impressed by it. So he gives Arnold 1,100 men, which is a lot for a guy who has very limited military experience, as Arnold had very little military experience.
And Steve, this was a disaster, right?
It was brutal. It was there they had these heavy bateaux, these boats they made to go up the river. It was cold. They ran out of food. They're trying to pull these heavy boats up and around the falls. Men were deserting. Men were getting sick and dying, rumored to eat their shoes. And so by the time they got to Quebec, it was a fraction of the force they had left with. Another neat thing in the collections in the exhibit we have here is the letter book that Benedict Arnold kept. So he kept an active correspondence through that trip, through that march, through that expedition, and wrote down all of his correspondence. So folks can see that here as well.
Steve, my mother went to middle school in Canada and she learned all about this, but Maine school kids didn't, did they?
No, I think, I think Alan, as I recall, you talked very eloquently about it in Ken Burns' documentary. But it was a tough slog. I think on one hand it's a point of pride, but I think we all wish it was more of a glowing victory to celebrate rather than just such a tough effort to get there. And very indicative again of Maine and the conditions in Maine during that time. It was not an easy place.
Yeah, and not an easy place. And anybody, even today, thinking about that route, Alan Taylor is thinking he thought what?
Yeah, it's not a natural route for an 18th century army because they've got a lot of gear to move. And there are a lot of rapids and falls you've got to get around. And you're going through a countryside which at that time had no farms. So if you run out of supplies, you're in a tough spot.
Well, you are going to be here in Maine, Alan Taylor, for a special event with the Maine Historical Society later this month, May 20th.
You're going to be talking, I understand, about a young man whose name was already mentioned on the program, Joseph Plum Martin. Without giving it all away, your talk at the Maine Historical Society. Tell us about Joseph Plum Martin and why he is important to history and also important to Maine. He wasn't from Maine, was he?
He wasn't originally from Maine. He will end up living most of his life in Maine after the Revolution. He is from Connecticut. He is the son of a minister, but his family has experienced downward mobility. So he ends up in the Continental Army, and he will serve for most of the war in the Continental Army in the ranks. So he's not an officer. He's a common soldier. By the end of the war, he will have risen to be a sergeant, a non-commissioned officer. So he writes the only book-length memoir by a common soldier of the Revolution. We have some quite shorter memoirs, particularly in the form of people who are applying for pensions long after the war. But we don't have another book-length manuscript by a common soldier other than Joseph Plum Martin. And the good news is he is a very frank writer. He's a very vivid writer. And he is often a very funny writer about the horrific experiences of being in this army. There's a lot of dark humor in it. And after the war, as was the case with other veterans of the war, the troops are just set adrift without their back pay. And so they are poor and desperate, and they need to support their families. And Joseph Plum Martin will then move to the shores of Penobscot Bay, settling in the town of Prospect. He will develop a family there. He never gets rich. He's a small farmer. And in that situation, he will find himself at odds with a former general of the Continental Army, Henry Knox, who is claiming that Joseph Plum Martin and these other settlers all have to pay for their farms, and they have to pay him.
Mm. So everything we're talking about comes full circle in the story of Joseph Plum Martin and Henry Knox.
Yes, it does. And so one of the great discoveries of my career was at the Maine Historical Society. They have papers of Henry Knox. And in there was a letter from Joseph Plum Martin to Henry Knox, begging Knox to cut him a break because Joseph Plum Martin didn't have the money to pay for his farm. Now, we don't have a reply from Knox that survives, but it's pretty clear that Knox did not cut him a break and Martin would lose his farm.
Mm. We are talking with historian Alan Taylor and Maine Historical Society Executive Director Steve Bromage about Maine's role in the Revolutionary War, about Maine, what Maine was like 250 years ago. What are your questions? Give us a call, 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email, talk@mainepublic.org. This is Maine Calling. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. As Maine and the country celebrate the nation's 250th anniversary, we learn about the role Maine played during the fight for freedom. Joining me to discuss this, Alan Taylor, Colby College graduate, Maine native, and Pulitzer Prize-winning historian, and Steve Bromage, Executive Director of the Maine Historical Society. Share your comments and questions. You can send us an email, a brief email, please, talk@mainepublic.org. Post a comment on Facebook or Instagram, or give us a call, 1-800-399-3566. Again, 1-800-399-3566. Steve, before we get much further, tell us about the event on May 20th.
Well, we're thrilled to have Alan Taylor joining us for a lecture and a conversation at First Parish Church here in Portland. We'll hear more about Joseph Plum Martin, and then we'll get to talk about Alan's career and his roots in Maine and his participation in Ken Burns' documentary. Should be a great evening.
All right. And that is Maine Public's media sponsor of the event. So you can purchase tickets at the Maine Historical Society website. Is that right?
That's correct.
All right. Well, we're going to go to questions here. And the first one's a good one. This is a question from Patrick in York. Would you consider the American Revolution a civil war more than a revolution? Alan Taylor.
Well, I will say it's both. And it's a civil war because it's a revolution. So a revolution is something that challenges the existing order. And all societies, when that happens, it's going to be divisive. There were conservatives within colonial society who thought that the relationship with Britain had been, on balance, a very positive one that provided law and order. And they're very concerned about the disruption of a revolution. So an attempt to create a revolution in a colonial society is going to generate powerful opposition. And that's what happened. So the revolution is not a simple story of Americans against the British. It's a story of Americans against Americans, with some of those Americans assisted by the British.
Mm. And part, Steve, and Alan, I'm sure you'll want to weigh in on this too. Part of the reason Maine wanted to separate from Massachusetts, correct, is because of how Maine was treated during and after the American Revolution, right?
Yeah, I think that's what just before the break, what Alan was describing, the conditions and the whose land was it, who would be settling here. It really did lead immediately from the revolution into those conflicts, which led to separation. And, you know, whether we were looked out and truly part of Massachusetts, or it was a kind of a repeat of the process in a certain sense.
Yeah, during the Revolution, there was a sense by the people living along the coast of Maine that they had been inadequately protected by Massachusetts from British attacks. And then there's a subsequent war, the War of 1812, where this concern appears once again. And that really then is the final push toward Maine becoming a state.
All right. And before the break, Steve, we mentioned the March on Quebec, which happened in 1775. Shortly after, another important event that happened in Maine was the Battle of Machias. Tell us about that.
Yeah, I think that really gets at some key Maine dynamics and a greater point of pride maybe than Arnold's March. And that was, Boston was under, the British in Boston were under siege. Henry Knox had brought those cannons across, and the British were desperate to have supplies, timber, to take care of the troops in Boston. So they came up the coast where there were long established trading relationships looking for supplies. But the Patriots and the folks around Machias weren't interested in trading with them. So there was some back and forth and conflict. And finally, the Patriots took over the British ship Margaretta. They really established a privateer force up in that neck of the woods that really continued throughout the war. So Mainers, the Patriots in Maine were really a challenge to the British, and it made it very difficult for them to proceed. So it was a result of that that led to the burning of Falmouth, which was Portland at that time, in a quick series of events. You know, that was British retaliation for the Battle of Machias. And that was one of the grievances that was cited in the Declaration of Independence, was the burning of our cities. A very significant and demonstrative of the dynamics in Maine.
And I'm so glad you brought that up, Steve. If anybody is interested in learning more about the fire, the Great Fire in Falmouth, we did an entire Maine Calling program on that. So you can find that as well. But before we move to calls, Alan Taylor, is there anything you would like to add about the importance of the Battle of Machias and then the burning of Portland, then called Falmouth?
Yeah, it's important to bear in mind that at the time of the Revolution, there's virtually no settlement by Euro-Americans of the interior. They're stretched along the coast. And the British Royal Navy is the most powerful navy in the world. And while the Patriots are able to organize privateers and a very small navy, it's not a significant challenge to British naval supremacy in the Gulf of Maine. So anybody who's living in one of these small communities, they're highly vulnerable. So to fight back against the British attempt to extract resources from Machias is an extremely courageous decision. But it's an important one for a couple of reasons. One is that it does escalate the conflict, and it does lead, sadly, to the destruction of much of what is now Portland. And that feeds into the Declaration of Independence. But the second reason is that Machias is a very isolated community, very far down east. And it means it's going to be a lot harder for the British to exercise control over eastern Maine, even though they will occupy Castine later in the war. Machias continues to hold out. And it strengthens the hand of American negotiators at the peace treaty that indeed the boundary of the United States should go all the way to the St. Croix River rather than stop, say, at the Penobscot. So the success at Machias and the enduring commitment of the people in and around Machias to the patriot cause is of great significance.
We'll go to Paul, who's calling from Portland. Hi, Paul. Go ahead.
Hi. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Great. Thanks. I'm calling on behalf of Friends of Fort Gorgeous, namesake for Maine's first colonial proprietor. Of course, everyone pronounces the name Gorgeous, and we just assume it's not pronounced that way, and we know little about him. Could you talk a little bit about Sir Fernando Gorgeous? Thank you.
Well, that's going way back into the early 17th century. When Gorgeous is he's a British aristocrat, English aristocrat. And he's very well connected to the monarchy. So he is able to get a land grant. And this is during the first decade of the 17th century when the very first English settlements are getting going, first at Roanoke, that doesn't work out, then at Jamestown. And Gorgeous is trying to establish one in Maine. And it's tough going and it does not endure. And Gorgeous will end up losing control over his land.
And Steve, do we know for sure how it was pronounced?
Good question. I'm not sure.
Yeah, we do all say Gorgeous.
I've always heard it called Gorgeous, but yes. Somebody in Britain would correct us.
Yeah. Paul, thanks for your question. I'm going to go to an email here from Kevin. Do you think that early, and this is from my colleague, Kevin Miller, do you think that the early tension and struggle between the proprietors and the settlers had long-lasting effects that are still evident in Maine today? Obviously, it's still reflected in so many place names, Waldo, Knox, Gardner, Liberty, Freedom, etc. But do you still see that the Liberty Men ethos is present today in Mainers or their politics, or in fact, that much of the North Woods is still divided up into huge tracts, often owned by large corporations? Alan.
Well, that's a great question. And I would say there are two parts to the answer. One is that the private property system that where the great proprietors prevailed in politics and the courts is something that's had enduring consequences. And you can certainly find it in the Maine woods today. The second part of it has to do with what sort of legacy does it have for the people who live in the region affected by this conflict right after the Revolution. And that is the region between the Androscoggin and the Penobscot Rivers. And as the question indicated, many of these towns have names like Union, Liberty, Freedom, and they have those names for a reason, is that the people who settled there were quite militant in their view of the Revolution as properly creating greater opportunity for common people. So I do find I've spent a fair amount of time in that corner of Maine. It's a big corner of Maine. I have been featured as a bicentennial speaker for the town of Montville and then also for Whitefield. And in both of these towns, the towns are founded during this period of conflict between the settlers and the great proprietors. And the local people in those communities are very aware of this legacy.
Go ahead, Steve.
Jennifer, I think that too just gets at the relevancy of the 250th and the importance of Maine history to Maine today, which I think is a lot of ways we try to look at it. You can't understand and appreciate Maine, its special sense of place, its challenges, without looking at that history and the identity that we inherit from our parents and grandparents and great-grandparents, you know. So across political and cultural and socioeconomic makeup of Maine, it's really interesting, the 250th, you know, to think about what brings us to today, what are our responsibilities, what Maine means to us. And so I think the 250th, all to have these conversations is a really great opportunity.
An email here from Kathy. Speakers indicated 45,000 to 50,000 people in Maine in the 1770s. Does this include our indigenous people? Also, how did the Wabanaki people contribute to any of the dynamics of the revolution? Kathy, thank you. Fantastic question. Alan Taylor.
Those figures do not include the Wabanaki, but they are still a very important presence, that is more important than their mere numbers. We were probably talking, throughout Maine, we're probably talking in the vicinity of 2,000 to 3,000 native peoples. Not all of them are Wabanaki, but a majority of them would be. And their primary homes are in the Penobscot River Valley. They play a very important role because they affiliated with the Patriots. And the Patriots cultivated them. And that's extremely important to the security of the settlements along the coast, because they're already facing the threat from the British Navy and privateers in the Gulf of Maine. If they're also facing a threat from native peoples in the interior, then that doubles their problems. But the native peoples decided that their interest lay in a cooperation with the settlers for mutual security. And the new United States made it a priority to obtain a Catholic priest, because one of the things that the native peoples especially wanted was a Catholic priest. They had been converted to Catholicism under French influence. The British had conquered the French in Canada, and after that, the native peoples had great difficulty getting a priest. So the native peoples, with the help of the United States, obtained a French priest from France who came, and he then bolsters the commitment of the native peoples of Maine to support the Patriots rather than assist the British.
Let's see here. Thank you for that question. We will go to Mark calling from Thomaston. Hi, Mark. Go ahead.
Yes, hi. I think one overlooked fact when you're talking about Benedict Arnold going up the Dead River there was that Congress would not give him canoes, which is what he wanted. They wouldn't spend the money for those. The canoes would be swift. They wound up with the bateaux. Very heavy, I think even close to 900 pounds maybe, and greenwood, and they just had a terrible time with them. And I believe there's one Serampas Falls up there with just tremendous fatalities. Anyway, I thought I'd pass that along, and I think that was one of Benedict Arnold's main sticking points to become a turncoat, actually. But anyway, that's my two cents on it.
Well, thank you, Mark, for that. We also have another question from Gail wondering what happened with Benedict Arnold that made us call him a traitor today. So I'll turn to you, Alan Taylor. The first point, Mark's point, if Benedict Arnold had canoes instead of these very heavy bateaux, would history be different today?
Well, there are a lot of what was just said that I agree with, and some of which I don't entirely agree with. He's got a lot of heavy equipment he's got to haul. And so canoes would have been insufficient for what he had to do. So the problem is not so much the use of bateaux. It's the use of bateaux that are freshly built with fresh wood, and they had not dried sufficiently to be waterproof. Oh. So it's the badly designed, hastily built bateaux that are the problem rather than bateaux. Because bateaux were the working boats of the river systems of North America. And so there's a lot of experience using bateaux. But this was a bad set of bateaux. And so it's not a problem that Congress said you can't have canoes, because Congress isn't involved in this decision at all. Now, Benedict Arnold will later have a lot of disputes with Congress, but those disputes are over his own promotion and pay and compensation for his expenses in a variety of campaigns. And he will end up souring and feeling that Congress is ungrateful to him for his military achievements, haven't rewarded him sufficiently. He, at that point, He has just married a young woman who is a loyalist from a loyalist family, and she focuses his grievances as having a solution of turning to the British. But
Mark,
that won't happen until 1779.
All right. Mark, thank you so much for your question. We are talking with historian Alan Taylor and Maine Historical Society Director Steve Bromage about Maine's role in the Revolutionary War and also what Maine was like during that period. What are your questions? Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. If you're quick, you can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. We're learning about the history during the Revolutionary War era in Maine. Joining me, Steve Bromage with the Maine Historical Society and University of Virginia, Emeritus Professor, and Pulitzer Prize-winning author Alan Taylor. Share your comments and questions. You can send an email to talk@mainepublic.org. You can also post on Facebook or Instagram, or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. Again, 1-800-399-3566. An email here from Donald. He says, could you touch briefly on the Penobscot expedition? Who wants to take that one?
Well, I'll take it on. The British had sent a naval force with troops to occupy position at Castine. There was a small fort there, but they built a much more substantial one. And then the government of Massachusetts said, we need to try to oust this force. So they had a state navy, not a U.S. Navy, but a Massachusetts state navy. And they sent up a force of militiamen, including Paul Revere, to try to, and also a guy named Peleg Wadsworth. And so the house that's right next to the Maine Historical Society, which is called the Longfellow Wadsworth House, is Peleg Wadsworth's house that he builds after the Revolution. But during the Revolution, Wadsworth is along as a subordinate commander in this expedition. And this expedition is a disaster because a much larger British fleet comes along, traps them in the Penobscot River. They are obliged, because they're incapable of fighting superior numbers, they're obliged to scuttle their ships, burn them, and then to try to hoof it across the wilderness of Maine to try to escape from the British. And most of them did so escape from the British, but at the loss of this state fleet, which is economically ruinous to the finances of Massachusetts.
We have a question here from Kristen. What are the top three places to visit with kids to learn about Maine history? Asking as a homeschool mom. Steve, what would you recommend?
Well, there are great places and great opportunities this year. I would, of course, say Maine Historical Society is a great place to start. This year, we have a wonderful exhibition that looks at these 250 years of history. But there's also lots of activities going on around the state commemorating it. You know, places like Presque Isle have a lot of activities. And the Maine State Museum will be reopening later this fall after a number of years closed. So I think between MHS and the Maine State Museum, then there are a lot of wonderful local places as well.
Okay. We'll go to Harold Prince, who's calling in. Harold Prince is a friend of Maine Calling, has been on the program many times, and a professor emeritus of anthropology at Kansas State. Hi, Harold.
Hello, Jennifer. I appreciate you getting me on, and I much enjoyed the conversation that you're having with Alan Taylor, who I never had the pleasure of meeting in person, but I'm familiar with his work, of course, and also with Steve Bromage. And the question is, regarding Wabanaki participation, there's much more to it, of course, than what you just heard, too much really for this program. But I would like to mention the importance of June 21st, 1775, right in the wake of a Bunker Hill disaster for the Revolutionary Army that was just beginning. And that was the invitation to get Chief Orono and three other Penobscot warriors to Watertown. They were specifically fetched, and he pledged support on the 21st of June, 1775. And that, of course, is now Native American Veterans Day in Maine, as instituted as a result of the initiative by Chief Orono's descendant, Charles Norman Shea, who passed away last year. And I'd like just to bring that to the attention of your audience. And the other thing is, of course, the Treaty of Watertown, 19th of July, 1776, precisely when the information about the Declaration of Independence reaches Massachusetts, there were 10 Wabanaki leaders from eastern Maine and what is now called New Brunswick and Nova Scotia were actually in Watertown at that time signing the Treaty of Watertown. And we have a beautiful copy of that treaty, the very first treaty that the United States, as a newly formed republic, actually signed with any nation, not just with any indigenous nation, but also well before the treaty with France. And so it's a replica of that that treaty of Watertown signed on the 19th of July by those 10 Wabanaki chiefs that is at the Abbey Museum at an exhibit that my wife, Bunny McBride, and I are co-guest curating with a commentary on that treaty. I would just like to bring that to your attention because also in the debacle of 1779, in the failed attack to dislodge the British at what's now called Castine, Wabanaki were also involved. There were many, many involvements of Wabanaki people who paid a high price for their participation. And lastly, it is not just because they wanted a priest. The key thing that Orono brings to the table in Watertown in 1775 is the ongoing encroachment of tribal territories that he wants to see stopped, and that was promised, and that promise was broken.
Harold, thank you so much for calling in. Harold Prince, Steve Bromage, you wanted to jump in?
Yeah, thanks for that, Harold. I think one of the really wonderful ways that Mainers will have the opportunity to participate in the 250th and learn more about these specific stories is we're doing a statewide tour of our copy of the Dunlop broadside of the Declaration of Independence this year. Each of the stops in each of Maine's different 16 counties is an opportunity to learn about the revolution in that part of the state. But to Harold's point, you know, one of the fascinating things, the Abbey Museum will be hosting the Declaration and doing programming related to it. So there'll be opportunities to take the Declaration and all of its complexities and really see and study it in the context of 13,000 years of Wabanaki history and stories and in that context. So I think there are a lot of different ways to think about and learn and come at these stories. But that tour and what the Abbey is doing this summer will be a really wonderful way to encounter those stories specifically.
Hmm. And Alan Taylor, anything you would like to add to Harold Prince's, what Harold Prince has said today?
Well, he's absolutely right that another key part of it is the pledges that are made that they're going to protect the homelands of the native peoples in Maine in return for their assistance. And that's a promise that's broken. It's a similar story that plays out with the Oneida people of the Haudenosaunee Confederation in New York. I'll also say that I did meet Harold and Bunny many, many years ago as part of a panel with Tom Tureen talking about the Penobscot Native people's history in Maine and the ways in which they had been betrayed in the promises that were made to them. But that was long ago. It has to be over 30 years ago now.
Well, Harold, thank you again. It's always a pleasure to hear your voice. Thank you for calling into Maine Calling today. Let's see. We will go to Jennifer calling from Wells. Hi, Jennifer. Go ahead.
Hi. How are you?
Good.
I've got a question for Steve and Alan about how they would feel about the current administration and thoughts on how the Founding Fathers would think about the current administration.
We're talking about Janet Mills?
I'm thinking more of Donald Trump. And
I assume so. I was joking. I'm going to let Steve handle this. He's more politic than I am.
Thanks, Alan. Well, you know, I think that really brings the 250th to another place. And I think one of the real opportunities of this moment is for us to really reflect on what we each think about what it means to be American and what our responsibilities are as a citizens. You know, so again, to go back to the Declaration of Independence and the founding period and to look at the soaring ideals that are expressed in the Declaration, but also recognizing the imperfection at that time when the Declaration was passed, you know, revolutionary principles outlined there, but women couldn't vote. African Americans were still slaved. Indigenous people were called out in horrific ways in Grievance 27 of the Declaration. So, you know, life is messy. Life is complex. We have been working for 250 years to try to perfect this country, and we still have a lot of work to do. So I think the opportunity for us is to tune out some of the cultural and political noise and really get back to talking to each other as Mainers and Americans and really saying, what do we want this country to look like and how do we treat each other? You know, for all the political and cultural challenges, and it's a very disconcerting time. I travel throughout the state constantly, and I'm blown away by the quality and the respect of people everywhere. You know, so I think we just have to put it back on our shoulders and selves and say, how do we want to live as Mainers in America? And let's set an example.
Jennifer, thanks for calling in. Alan Taylor, Steve Bromage mentioned women, and we haven't talked yet about what the revolution meant for women. In fact, I'd like to talk about what it meant for non-white men, for women and for those who were enslaved in Maine, because slavery was still legal in Maine until 1823.
Well, it's not legal in Maine after the early 1780s. Now, there are still people, the enforcement of...
Oh, I'm sorry, 1783. I'm looking at the wrong date on my piece of paper. Go ahead. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
That's all right. But the larger point stands, which is that we ordinarily focus on the military achievements and political achievements of white men in the revolution. But it's important to bear in mind that the revolution is, in many ways, a total war. It involves the entire civilian population. It is not a war that's just fought in nice, neat battles. It affects the home front. The forces of the Continental Army and the militia, they require support from the home front. And the home front is involved in the war in that both sides are raiding farms and communities. They're burning places like Falmouth, now Portland. It's a war that affects every woman, every non-white person, every child throughout the 13 colonies that will become the 13 United States. And so historians increasingly have been paying attention to the entire population of revolutionary America, loyalist as well as patriot, women as well as men, children as well as adults, non-whites as well as white people, in order to understand an experience that is a traumatic one and an inspirational one for the entire population. It's not inspirational if you're a loyalist, but it's potentially inspirational if you're a patriot and you have a vision of an improved society that could come out of the revolution.
Steve.
Yeah, Jennifer, and I think that's one of the organizing principles of our Pathways to Freedom exhibit we have at Maine Historical Society. And again, making the parallels between Mainers today and then during the revolutionary period, it features six different Mainers who bring these different perspectives. There's an Molly Agat, an Abenaki doctor, who's featured, William Bailey, a patriot, Prince Dunsick, who entered the war as a slave. And it looks at these six characters and really looks at the different perspectives of Mainers and gets at the complexity that Alan talking about. One of the neat things is, like Ken Burns' documentary, there's not a lot of visual material and photographs of those people. So we have created those six characters as Anna May characters. So it's just a kind of an interesting, fun way to kind of get people's heads around what was that era like and how does it relate to us today.
We'll go to Glenn in Penobscot. Glenn, we're tight on time. So if you could ask your question quickly, that'd be wonderful.
Yeah, I just want to hear more about the conflict between the large landowners and the common people, how that got resolved, and basically who won.
Alan Taylor. You can probably guess, Glenn. Go ahead.
It's a complicated story, so I'd encourage you to read this book, Liberty Men and Great Proprietors, which was the first book that I wrote, which is about the whole story. But to summarize, it depends on what community you're in as to who won. There are parts of the Lincoln County coast where the settlers did quite well, and elsewhere in the central part of Maine, in general, the great proprietors prevailed.
Glenn, thank you for your question. We have an email here from Katie. Katie Murphy, reporting from North Yarmouth Historical Society. I'm proud to report that our town of North Yarmouth has an original copy of the Declaration of Independence, as was sent to all towns throughout then Massachusetts back in 1776. It was kept diligently by town clerks throughout the years and is securely cared for today at the Maine State Archives. We will be exhibiting a digital copy of our declaration at our town center celebration on May 30th. Katie, thank you so much for sending that in, and that is pretty darn special. And I want to thank both of our guests today for being here with us. You heard the voice you just heard was Alan Taylor, two-time Pulitzer Prize-winning historian, former history professor at the University of Virginia, and a Colby College graduate. Also here, Steve Bromage, the executive director of the Maine Historical Society. And don't forget to visit the Maine Calling website or the Maine Historical Society website for more information about Professor Taylor's upcoming lecture on May 20th. Today's sound engineer was Sandra Harris. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. Tomorrow on the program, a look at Maine humor in everyday life. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You have been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.